Now it's only 29 studying, 3 o'clock, Thursday afternoon, Arkansas Camp 1982. We turn now to the contemplation of the ninth chapter of Revelation, which deals, of course, with the fifth and sixth trumpets. A great deal of history is involved here, which I don't plan to take up in great detail. I'm very interested to read a note here in the Seventh Adventist source book, Volume 9 of the Commentary Series, page 508, an article on Islam seen as a reaction against corrupt Christianity. And the original source was Dennis Bailey, or Bally, Multitudes in the Valley, pages 266 and 267, written back in 1957 and printed in Greenwich, Connecticut. And on page 266 we read the following: Islam is the most resistant system of the world to Christian missionary endeavor. Its strength lies in its simplicity, and the truth which it proclaims above all others is the authority and unity of God. Originally, God's rebuke for the corrupt teaching and disunity of the Church of Muhammad's day, it has endured because it, in their modern forms, these things still persist. As long as Christians permit themselves the luxury of their divisions, so long as the West rejects the absolute demands of the Creator, as long as a major section of Christendom toys with the idea of a co-redemptrix, this goes back to the original protest of Muhammad, who was so impressed by the excessive devotion paid to the Virgin Mary that he understood that she formed a member of the Christian Trinity. So long will Islam endure to throw back the falsehood in their teeth. Now, I read this statement because we are emphasizing, or we're finding emphasized in the Word of God, that Babylon's troubles were Babylon originated. In other words, the judgments which fell upon pagan Rome first of all, and then papal Rome second of all, are the fruit or the harvest of their own sowing. Exactly as you read back in Great Controversy, page 35, in regard to the Jews and the destruction and dispersion of their nation. It always will be the same. Now, just in case you missed the point, I'll just emphasize it right now. And that is that originally, God's rebuke to the corrupt teaching and disunity of the Church of Muhammad's day, in other words, back in Muhammad's day, he was protesting because of the corrupt nature of the Roman Catholic Church of that time. Now, by the way, Muhammad was, I'm not sure when he was born, but we're told that he died in the year 632 AD, and that it was in 622 that he fled from Mecca and began to really become an influence in the world of that time. So shortly after, the Roman Catholic Church gained world supremacy, and 1260 years had begun, the Roman Catholic Church began to breed rebellion against herself. And one of these breedings of rebellion was marked by the rise of Muhammad, the so-called prophet, which gave birth to the Muhammadan religion, which today, of course, is called Islam. And we know that there's a tremendous controversy today between the Islamic world and the Jewish world, and certainly, of course, the Islamics are doing trying to do their level best to hurt the West when they put up the cost of oil by more than twice its original prices, and show tremendous disrespect for the Western system. At the present time, of course, the most fanatical of all forms of Islam is the Ayatollah Khomeini, who resides in the land of Iran, and hates everybody, even fellow Islamics across the border in Iraq, and above all, of course, with a passionate hate of the Jewish people. Now, the interesting thing is this, that when the Roman Catholic system breeds reactions against herself, then she only breeds another kind of rebellion, very, very much like her own. Let's, for instance, make a note in regard to this. We'll look at another reaction to Romanism, which was the French Revolution, which began in the year 1789, and atheism took the place of Roman Catholicism in the land of France. Now tell me, how much change of character does it require to change from being a Roman Catholic to an atheist? Change of character? None. Change of ideology? Yes. Change of argument? Yes. Change in perhaps some outward forms of religion? Yes. But when it comes to change of character, none is required. Now, when you read the story of the French Revolution, what do you find? Do you find love? No. You find hatred, a spirit of revenge. You find an extremely destructive disposition. because during that time they set the guillotine up and literally tens of thousands of people perished at the hands of that awesome weapon of destruction. We're told in contemporary writings that the streets of Paris ran red with blood, the gutters ran red with blood, which poured into the Seine, the river which passes through Paris and stained its waters for many, many miles. And so the savagery, and that's the best word to use, the savagery which was unleashed in the French Revolution had been learned in the churches of Rome. And the people only then did to the priests what the priests had previously done to them. So how much change of character was involved? None whatsoever. And likewise, when the Shah of Iran was deposed and forced to flee a few years ago, and a revolution swept through Iran under the leadership of the Ayatollah Khomeini, remember that this man charged the Shah with being a despot, with being a torturer, with being a murderer, with being a person who unjustly imprisoned people without trial. But what do we find the Ayatollah doing? The same things, only worse, much worse. So again, how much change of character is involved? None. The point I'm making is this. It's a very important point. It is that the Roman Catholic system only breeds other systems like herself, just as rebellious, just as murderous, just as oppressive, just as cruel, just as destructive. And it becomes apparent from the article which I have just read by this observant historian, and I think that his point is quite soundly made, that the Islamic religion was bred by the abuses in the Roman Catholic Church. And interestingly enough, and perhaps quite surprisingly enough, that these systems bred by the Roman Catholic system become the haters and destroyers of the Roman Catholic system. They have the same spirit, but they don't have unity. They're not one. Whereas we find that wherever the Spirit of Jesus Christ sows the seed of truth, and in turn the seed of Christ, we find that this links Christians of every nation, kindred, tongue and people as one brother, as one family. And those who formerly were most desperate enemies now become the very best of friends and the closest of brothers. Which shows an enormous difference, of course, between these two systems of religion. Now, the change from being an atheist to being a member of this movement requires what? A change of character, doesn't it? What is the preeminent qualification for being a member of this movement? I'm saying now, a true member of this movement, not just an adherent who comes along as a foolish virgin, but to be a true member of the body of Christ, what is the preeminent qualification? A new nature, which is a change of character. Is that right? The change from being a Roman Catholic to being one of us requires a change of character. The change from an atheist to being one of us requires the same change of character. And to change back the other way requires a change of character too, doesn't it? Because you can't become an atheist without being a different kind of person altogether. And this is a dominant thought which I want to stress in the Seven Trumpets, and especially, of course, in regard to the French Revolution, what I've read so far in respect to the rise of the Islamic hordes is an introduction, shall we say, a smaller picture of what we shall see when the French Revolution rose as a tremendous reaction against so-called Christianity, Roman Catholic Christianity. Let's come back to Revelation chapter 9 now, keeping this thought very much in mind. And we read now in verse 2, "And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit." Now, Uriah Smith, I'm not going to read too much more of him because he starts to become too geographical in his interpretation, and he likens the bottomless pit, which comes from the Greek word abyssos or bysos, which means a wilderness or a desolate place. He likens this to the geographically desolate areas of Arabia, and that part of the world where the Islamic religion first began to gain prominence. There's quite a good documentary film in circulation some time ago about the life of Muhammad, which is worth seeing, I think. And we need to be reasonably conversant with these developments back in human history. But I don't see the bottomless pit as being any geographical area upon the surface, rather a spiritual condition or state of being. Because if we're going to interpret the word bottomless pit, as Uriah Smith does, let's see if I can just pick up the words again. Where did I see here a moment ago? Right, bottom of page 496. The meaning of this term may be learned from the Greek abyssos, which is defined deep, bottomless, and profound, and may refer to any waste, desolate, and uncultivated place. It is applied to the earth in its original state of chaos, Genesis 1 verse 2. In this instance, it may appropriately refer to the unknown waste of the Arabian desert, from the borders of which issued the hordes of Saracens like swarms of locusts. Now, if that interpretation is valid, then the same interpretation must be given to the same words in Revelation chapter 11 verse 7, which says, "And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them and shall overcome them and kill them." Now, where did this beast arise geographically? In France. And is France a desolate and waste place? It's a beautiful country. I've driven through it. I've flown over it. It's a verdant, well-farmed land with beautiful pastures and vineyards and orchards and rivers flowing through the country. It's not a waste and desolate place like Arabia. So therefore, Uriah Smith could not apply the word bottomless pit in Revelation chapter 11, the same as he does back in Revelation chapter 9. Therefore, he has an inconsistent type of interpretation, and therefore, it must be rejected, because you cannot have inconsistent, disharmonious methods of interpretation in the Word of God. It can't be done. We have to find an interpretation which fits both the verdant valleys of France and the desolate wastes of Arabia, right? So therefore, the expression bottomless pit is a spiritual or antitypical application rather than a geographical and material application. Now, I think that most of you are aware of the fact, of course, we don't apply geographical interpretations anyway. That is, in this movement. Because to do so gets us into very serious difficulty. For instance, Uriah Smith again quite correctly identifies modern Babylon without any kind of reference to geographical borders. If we were today to use geographical interpretation to determine the location of modern Babylon, where would we find ourselves looking? No, say it again, geographical. If we today would apply geographical principles of interpretation, in other words, if modern Babylon is identified by the power which now occupies the territory, the geographical territory, once occupied by ancient Babylon, we are using geographical interpretation, aren't we? Okay? So then if we're using geographical interpretation to identify modern Babylon, where would we look? Middle East, right? The banks of the Euphrates River. And when we look there, what do we find? Nothing. So we're in trouble, aren't we? Now, because nothing can be found there, Uriah Smith correctly interprets Babylon to be a worldwide power not confined by any geographical boundaries whatsoever. But then when he comes to the King of the North in Daniel chapter 11, verse 40, he says, and perhaps I should just read the words to you because they're quite interesting, in this connection, he makes it very, very clear that the one and only way, he says, of identifying modern Babylon is to, the modern King of the North is to ask which power today occupies the same geographical territory which was once occupied by the ancient King of the North. We'll find here in a moment, verse 39, verse 40, right, should be here on page 293. Doesn't seem to be. It's page 295. And, of course, as you know, Uriah Smith identifies the modern king of the north as being Turkey, a very insignificant power which has passed off the scene of action anyway, the mouth of nothing anymore, and certainly is not the king of the north of the last days. But Uriah Smith said, but it's Turkey, now occupying the territory which constituted the northern division of Alexander's empire, is not the king of the north of this prophecy, then we are left without any principle to guide us to the interpretation. In other words, Uriah Smith is saying that the only way to identify the King of the North is geographical principles of interpretation. Geographical principles say that whatever power today occupies the geographical territory once occupied by the King of the North, that is the modern King of the North. That's the only principle, he says, by which it can be guided, which is contradicting Uriah Smith. It's Uriah Smith versus Uriah Smith. Because when he comes to Babylon, I said a moment ago, he doesn't identify Babylon by asking the question, what power today occupies the same territory. Now, we in this movement apply what we call the gospel system of interpretation, and the gospel system is based upon the principle that it is what you are that makes you who you are, not where you are that makes you who you are. Right? Now, for instance, when the great city of Babylon fell, and the religion, the theology of that tremendous system of evil no longer occupied that geographical territory on the banks of the Euphrates River, and the Mithraic priests took the Babylonian culture to Rome and to Pergamos, Babylon now relocated in Rome, and in Pergamos was Babylon still. Geography hadn't changed there, not in the slightest. And when today she's still beyond those borders to occupy almost the entire world, because even in those lands where communism today rules supreme, the Catholic religion is very powerfully there, as is proved, of course, by the Pope's recent visit to Poland. When he went to Poland, what did he find? Hundreds of thousands of folk came out to worship him. And make no mistake, in Russia and Czechoslovakia and these countries, we find likewise that there is a strong Catholic element in those places too. And the same thing is true so far as the King of the South is concerned and all the rest. And the expression bottomless pit does not mean a physically waste place upon the face of the earth. What it does mean, or did back of course in Genesis chapter 1, because that's back in the typical times, in these great prophecies, of course, where symbolic language is being used, it is applied to a waste place which is being caused by the teaching of error, and that teaching of error results, of course, in atheism. So basically, a bottomless pit is an atheistic religion. Of course, the Islamics believe or pretend they believe in God, but their God is Allah, not the real God of heaven. And certainly, of course, by the policy which they use of mass slaughter, the idea, the way in which the Mohammedan converts the Christians is to take him by the hair with sword beats throat and say, right, what should it be, death or Islam? And the Christian said, I'll be an Islamic, his life is spared. If he said, I'll be a Christian, his life is taken. Actually, you get a lot of converts that way. You'd build a church up very rapidly if we did that. So I don't think we'd really build a church up here. It would be a case of bringing in elements which would destroy the beautiful principles we stand for, and God's Spirit certainly would not be present with us without the Spirit of God. How much can we really learn that pertains to eternal life? The answer is nothing, of course. So the tactic employed by Mohammedans is very simply Islam or death, take your pick. So then, the bottomless pit is the source of atheistic religion, an atheism which has a God of its own but denies the existence and presence and power of the real God. Now, tremendous darkness overspread the world because of this opening up of the bottomless pit, as we read here in chapter 9 and verse 2. And once again, I'd like to make the point that while the Roman Catholic Church itself was darkness, when she bred darkness, the darkness she bred was greater than her own darkness, wasn't it? Right? Now verse 3 says, there came out of the smoke a locust upon the earth, and unto them was given power, as the scorpions on the earth have power. Why would locust be an appropriate symbol for the Mohammedan hordes that swept across Europe? For several reasons. Now first of all, when we go back to Daniel the 7th chapter, we find that God chose as a symbol of ancient Babylon a lion with two wings. When you visit, if you ever do, I never have, and don't plan to either, when you visit the ruins of ancient Babylon and behold what's left of those walls, what will you find in carved or sculpted on those walls? Lions with wings, okay? And so God chose to identify Babylon by an insignia of her own. And we have the Medo-Persian bear, the Medo-Persian was a very great and ponderous military machine. It moved very rapidly. It had a lot of horsemen, a lot of foot soldiers, and they moved slowly and very ponderously across the world. But the next empire, the Grecians, was marked by exceeding swiftness, a leopard being a very fast animal, second about only to the cheetah, and having four wings, of course, indicated also the presence of great speed. Now, what insect is very common to the Middle Eastern world? Locusts. And when locusts go out, they go out in a tremendous swarm. They literally fly through the air so thick And when they crossed the sun, they darkened the day. And so just as the locusts came pouring out of those desert areas to devour all before them, down to the valleys of the Jordan, up to the valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates, up to various parts of Asia Minor, so the uncountable, the innumerable hordes of Saracens and Muslims and Islamists came pouring out of these desert areas to literally devour everything before them. And could you think of a more appropriate symbol for that vast horde of destroyers than the locusts? You couldn't, could you? They fitted the picture perfectly, just as the winged lion superbly fitted the picture of ancient Babylon. And let's come on down to verse 4 and 5. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their forehead. Now I rather think that the expression grass and green thing and any tree is not referring to vegetation as such, although of course they sure left a white earth policy behind them. But here we have a contrast in the first half of the verse, where it refers to one thing to what it talks about in the last half of the verse. And what does the last half of the verse talk about? It talks about those who have not the seal of God in their foreheads. Therefore, the grass and the green things and the trees in the first part of the verse must refer also to people who do or did have the seal of God in their foreheads. And do we find that trees are symbols of people? Back in Psalms, of course, we find that a Christian is likened to a tree planted by what kind of location? Beside a river, and said that he would remain green and would not waste away as does the heathen whose tree is planted out in a desert area. So verse 5 then, or verse 4 rather, talks about two classes of people: those who are green, those who are living, those who are trees in the garden of God, as a contrast against those who have not the seal of God in their forehead. Now, the hatred of the Islamic world was not directed against Christians as such, that is, true Christians. Their hatred was directed against the Roman Catholic system, against the papacy, because it was the abuses in the papacy which spawned or bred in the Islamic world the direct, unquenchable hatred that those races feel towards the Roman Catholic power. The same as today, the Russian world is not at all concerned about a little movement like ourselves, although of course they might find it difficult to distinguish between us who carry the Bible and Catholics who carry the Bible, but their great grievance is against the Roman Catholic world, against the Pope of Rome, and the Russians, I'm sure, would love to get rid of all the Catholics from Poland, Romania, Czechoslovakia, and those other Eastern Bloc nations. And it is a fact, too, that the Islamic hordes did not trouble the true Christian believers, the great reformers and so forth. They directed their hatred and malice against the Roman Catholic system or the papal system. Now verse 5, and to them it was given that they should kill them. Kill who? Those men which have not the seal of God in their forehead. Pardon? I beg your pardon, my mistake. And then it was given they should not kill them, but that they should torment them 5 months, and their torment was as the torment of a scorpion who strikes a man. Right, now, let me come across to the next trumpet, which deals with the loosing of the four angels which abandoned the great river Euphrates. We'll then notice that the river Euphrates was not dried up, as it is, of course, under the sixth plague. Now, I think there's a very clear connection between these two statements. They were not to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months of 150 years. The date of which we'll pick up in just a moment from Uriah Smith's book. I'm quite sure he's right on that point, because we have Sister White's endorsement of the time periods which were mapped out by the early Advent reformers. Let's come to that for just a moment. Well, we'll read it now on page 500. And to them it was given they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months, and their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. Their constant incursions into Roman territory and frequent assaults on Constantinople itself were an unceasing torment against throughout the empire, which yet they were not able effectively to subdue, notwithstanding the long period afterwards more directly alluded to, during which they continued by unremitting attacks grievously to affect an idolatrous church of which the Pope was the head. Their charge was to torment and then to hurt, but not to kill or to utterly destroy. The marvel was they did not. Well, I didn't even mention the date, the time period there, so we'll pick it up a little bit further on. We come no doubt to the sixth trumpet. Now this does not mean, of course, that not one of the enemies of the Saracens was never killed. They certainly slaughtered thousands upon thousands of so-called Christians, perhaps tens of thousands of them in the fearful battles which were fought over that long period of time. But what it does mean is this: they did not wipe out the Roman system, they tormented it, they irritated it, they punished it, they hurt it, but they could not destroy it, which we know, of course, from the outcome of history. And that torment was so severe, of course, that in those days shall men seek death and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle, and on their heads were, as it were, crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men, and they had hair as the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions. And they had breastplates, as it were, breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle, and they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, from the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. And one woe is past, and behold, there come 2 woes more hereafter. I don't plan to go into every one of these points in detail, because it takes a long time, but obviously, of course, we have a picture here of a people who rode with great swiftness, who were extremely destructive, who were ruthless, and had no care for human life, and as such brought tremendous woes and trouble upon the Roman world, or the Roman Catholic world. Let's look now on page 502 and 503 of this period, to hurt men for 5 months, referred to down in verse 10. It is also referred to back in verse 5. Both verse 5 and verse 10, we have the same period of time referred to. Page 502 in the book Daniel Revelation, the question arises, what men were they to hurt 5 months? Undoubtedly the same they were afterwards to slay, see verse 15, the third part of men, or third of the Roman Empire, the Greek division of it. When were they to begin this work of torment? The 11th verse answers the question. They had a king over them. The death of Muhammad, until near the close of the 13th century, the Muhammads were divided into various factions and the civil leaders, with no general civil government extending over them all. Near the close of the 13th century, Othman founded a government which has since been known as the Ottoman government or empire, which grew until it extended over all the principal Mohammedan tribes, consolidating them into one grand monarchy. Their king is called the Angel of the Bottomless Pit. An angel signifies a messenger, a minister, either good or bad, and not always a spiritual being. Now, of course, behind this particular king was the presence of Satan, who is the real Abaddon, or the real Apollyon. And the earthly king was a king by these names only in a secondary sense. This is made clear, of course, by the fact that back in Ezekiel 28 we find that the king of Tyre was referred to, but the real being referred to was the person behind the scenes, namely Satan. The king of Tyre had never been physically up in heaven to stand in the presence of God as a covering cherub, as the king of Tyre was said to have done. And obviously, of course, the reference goes beyond the earthly figurehead to the real person behind, which was Satan. And so while the earthly king Othman can be regarded as being Apollyon or Abaddon, who was the real king by this name? Satan, very clearly and very obviously. Now, coming to some dates, I'm not what you call really strong in this history, I'll admit that quite frankly, because there's such a lot of it to go through, and for me the actual history is not so terribly important, but rather that we understand the principle that Babylon was bringing upon herself these tremendous judgments of punishment. And on page 505 we have the calculations put down in a few simple words. And their power was to hurt men 5 months. And this is the computations worked out by Josiah Litch and published in 1838 in a little book called Christ's Second Coming. And thus far their commission extended to torment by constant depredations, but not politically to kill them. 5 months, 30 days to a month, 150 days, that is 150 years, commencing July 27, 1299, the 150 years reached to 1449. During that whole period, the Turks were engaged in almost perpetual war with the Greek Empire, but yet without conquering it. They seized upon and held several of the Greek provinces, but still Greek independence was maintained in Constantinople. But in 1449, the termination of the 150 years, a change came, the history of which will be found under the succeeding prophets. Let's put those dates on the board then, from July 27, 1299 to 1449. Right, July 27, 1299 to 1449. That's where we go, 150 years more down the road. And during that time, we find history provides us with the fulfillment in that the papal power was attacked by the Turks constantly during that period, but without actually conquering the nation or killing it. And this brings us down to the sixth prophet, which begins in verse 13 of Revelation chapter 9. And we certainly cannot take Urias' interpretation for the great river Euphrates as brought to view in this particular lesson. And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God, saying to the sixth angel, which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, and a day, and a month, and a year, for to slay the third part of men. This time they were going to go beyond simply tormenting them, there was to be actual slaughter, as we shall shortly see. And the number of the army of the horsemen was 200,000, and I heard the number of them. 200,000, of course, is a huge number of troops, to say the very least of it. But let's spend a moment or two looking at this great river Euphrates. And once again, we're calling for a consistent interpretation. Urias Smith, of course, says that the River Euphrates symbolizes those towns that geographically lived around the territory watered by this great river. When we come across to Revelation chapter 16, we have a third or another reference to the great river Euphrates in respect to the sixth plague, which says in verse 12, and the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof is dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. In Revelation chapter 17, we find a statement being given in regard to a woman whose name was Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, the abominations of the earth, sitting upon many waters in Revelation 17 verse 1. Now Babylon sits upon waters, and those waters are called Euphrates. This we learn, of course, from the Old Testament type of that great city. Let's now compare Revelation chapter 16 and the fall of Babylon back in ancient times. There was a city, and flowing diagonally across that city was the great river Euphrates, literally the lifeline of that great city. Now, the scriptures say in Revelation chapter 16 that the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. That is, of course, talking about an event which is yet future. In Revelation 16 verse 12, because we know that the seven last plagues have not yet come upon this earth, not yet. Now, if we take those words about the future and bring them back to the past, we find they're just as exactly true at the fall of Babylon in the past as they will be at the fall of Babylon in the future. Now, why do I say the fall of Babylon when Revelation 16 verse 12 doesn't mention Babylon? Let me ask you a question. What are the seven last plagues? They are the judgments upon what great city? Babylon. Therefore, the drawing up of the Euphrates in the seven last plagues must be inseparably connected with the fall of modern Babylon, just as the great river back there is dry up to bring about the fall of ancient Babylon. Now, the text says in regard to the future fall of Babylon, the water thereof is dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. Now let's take those words down and apply them to the fall of ancient Babylon. And as you know, King Cyrus dug this huge lake and diverted the water into the lake by throwing a rough dam across the dam. And what happens? The water of the great river Euphrates is dried up, that the way into the city of the king of the east might be prepared. And what happened in that one night? Babylon fell. Okay? Now we know, of course, that the Babylon in these last days, of whom we read in Revelation chapter 17, is not that literal city. It's a great mystical system of false religion which belts the entire world. And we also know that the waters on which that great city sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues, and that water can only be the Euphrates. Now, my point is that consistency demands that in every place where you see the word Euphrates, you must remember that Euphrates has a relationship to Babylon, which is inseparable. Right? It's inseparable. Now, in Revelation chapter 9, it talks about the river Euphrates. And that must be waters which symbolize the peoples which support the papal system, which is Babylon. And here we have peoples. And Revelation 17 verse 15 says, the waters which thou sawest are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. Then we ask ourselves the question, around about 1299 or 1499, when we get to the end of the 150 years, and we start the six trumpets, and we have a reference to the river Euphrates, then we first of all ask ourselves the question, where was Babylon centered or located in 1499? That's an easy question. Right? Rome. All right then. If Rome then was the Babylon of 1499 or 1500 or thereabouts, then where was Euphrates? Let's draw here a lightning map of Europe. You'll all come to the conclusion I'm not the world's best cartographer after you see this. There's Greece and the Black Sea, and there's Asia Minor and Palestine. Northern Africa, across here to the Iberian Peninsula, Spain, I mean France up here, and of course you must include the motherland up here, and Ireland. Recognize it? Okay, so here we find then there is the city of Rome, okay, and that was Babylon in the Middle Ages. Now Babylon, of course, is a symbolic or anti-typical term, and therefore that Babylon sat upon the great river Euphrates, symbolically speaking, just as surely as ancient Babylon sat upon the literal river Euphrates. And inasmuch as Euphrates is waters, and waters symbolize people, then where would you find on this map the great river Euphrates, spiritually speaking? Pardon? Everywhere. Not quite everywhere, but almost. Then we go back here, we have Islam, don't we? The locus. And the Islamics, during the fifth trumpet, had more or less driven the attacks of the Eastern Empire, and they'd hurt the Eastern Empire for those 150 years. So literally speaking, all the peoples of this area, more or less, make up the great river Euphrates at the time when the sixth trumpet began to sound. Now think of that river as being waters, and waters symbolize people, and people, just as the river Euphrates supported ancient Babylon, so the people support modern Babylon, and those people are the Euphrates. Right? Is that clear? That should be simple enough. Obviously, of course, it's not using geographical interpretation, which is a false system anyway. Right. Now, between the Roman world and the Islamic world, there was tremendous tension. There was a continual threat of open warfare. There was the avowed determination on the part of the Islamics to wipe out the Roman Catholic people entirely. That was their dedicated purpose. And any son of the Prophet Muhammad who killed a Christian, even if he died in the attempt, was thereby guaranteed an eternity of bliss as a reward for his noble effort. So therefore, the winds of strife were really puffing, ready to blow. But what prevented the fearful winds of strife from blowing up until a certain point of time, of course, if it wasn't for the four angels holding back the four winds of strife? And those angels were bound by God's command to stand, as shall we say, on the banks of the great river Euphrates until such time as they should be released. And what does the word of God say in Revelation chapter 9, verse 14? Loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. Now right now, of course, the angels who are holding back the four winds of strife are bound to stay in their position because of God's commands. But there's coming a time in the very near future, is there not, when the word will go forth, loose, and the four angels which are now bound at the four corners of the earth will release the winds of strife, and what's going to happen? Terrible desolation. And so likewise back there, when the angels who stood on the banks of the great river Euphrates were loosed from their responsibility, then what obviously had to happen, there was tremendous incursions by the Islamic world into the papal world. But remember, the river was not dried up, and therefore the papal system didn't fall. Whereas of course in Revelation chapter 16 we know that the river does dry up, and when it dries up, it brings about the destruction of modern Babylon.